Like free sports tickets, trips, and memorabilia so you can trick your friends, colleagues, and mistresses into thinking that you're some sort of high roller? Hey, join the club.
Welcome to the club.
The Fan Club. Log on to Sportsnet590.ca. Where you talking?
All right, Teeny Beans, Blue Jeans. It's Thursday, July the 3rd, 2014. Prime Time Sports on your radio, on your television, hour number two, the middle hour of the program. For now. When I reduce my schedule down to 2 hours a day, there will be no middle hour. There'll be a first hour and there'll be a last hour. Then I'll reduce it to 1 hour and then there'll be first and the last hour will be the same hour. And then there'll be no hours and then...
And you sell some more ads and you're done.
Adios. I'm out. I'm gone.
That was the hour.
That was it. Sorry. How are you, Smitty?
I'm good. What's going on?
That's Doug Smith of the Toronto Star.
Thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here. Although it's tough to follow.
Well, we invite you all the time, I know, but you never, you can never come.
Signings, trades, finals, drafts. The winter in the spring are a little bit busy.
Well, it's like you're busy all the time. Like we get to the off season and you still can't do it.
Ask me what I'm doing next week.
What are you doing next week?
I'm going to cover the British Open.
Oh, is this your first time?
Yes.
Where are they this year? Burkdale?
Hoylake.
Hoylake.
Yep, up in Liverpool.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have no idea what I'm doing, but...
Well, no, you know your golf.
Yes, but it's like 12 days in England, so I'm okay with that.
But it's up in Liverpool.
Yeah.
Attack like a Liverpoolian.
I don't know what I'm doing. I'll be like staying in the house with weeks and...
Oh, really?
Campbell. Are you? Yeah. Mark Millett.
So you're going to go visit all the Beatle places?
Probably, if I got a day, yeah. I figure I'll find a pub to watch soccer.
Do they still have that place? Was it called the Cave or whatever it was? What was it called, the place where the Beatles used to play?
No, the Cave was in Germany.
Oh, that was in Germany, yeah. Right. That's right. Yeah.
I don't know, but they got Penny Lane and Strawberry Fields. Don't they have that stuff there?
No, that's London.
Okay. Well, I'm going to London for 2 days at the end, so I'll see them there. But yeah, me and golf for like 12 days. It'd be great. Man, they hit it far.
The Cavern Club in London. In London or in Liverpool? Liverpool, see? The Cavern Club in Liverpool.
You know me.
If it closed in 1989?
Okay. Aww. I won't get there.
You're a little late.
I'm pretty sure there'll be a pub somewhere where I can become regular. Hey, it's me. Greetings from Canada.
I think there's a few pubs in Liverpool.
I would hope so.
What the hell else is there to do up there?
I don't know, but if anybody out there got some, let me know.
You can go pound on iron or something.
But it's a lot of work. You know that, covering golf. A lot of work. Gotta be there in the morning.
No, you don't, really.
Oh, no,
this is
actually.
The truth. The truth is, no, you don't.
You have to work at night? No, well, you don't have to work at night either. Let's see. They don't play night games.
So who's playing? Delat playing?
Yes, I believe so.
Hearn playing?
That I don't know. I don't think Mike's going.
Mike's not going?
I'm not sure, actually. I haven't checked the...
I should know. I was with Mike a week ago.
I don't think he is. I don't think he qualified. I don't think he's got an exemption over there yet. Still?
Yeah. Probably
but
not.
Tiger's coming back, right?
Who?
Tiger, that guy. Oh. Woods? Used to play a little bit?
Oh, yesterday's newspaper.
So that could be like 4 or 7 days writing right there.
Well, yeah, you'll spend a lot of time talking about what, you know, where he is, you know, in his game and his return and, you know. His,
beyond.
Yeah. And everybody, but people will gobble it up.
They do.
People can't get enough of that guy.
I don't quite get it, but not anymore. I got it when he was winning every major, but I don't quite get it in the last 4 years.
Have you spent much time with him?
No. Scrums, never one-on-one, that's for sure.
And no, I never have either. Do you find him likable?
No.
I don't either.
I find him detached and very guarded and a little disingenuous.
You know, they say that one of the least liked guys on the tour is Mickelson.
That I know to be true.
Yes. And yet, as much as I want to dislike him, he has this, it may be fake, but he has a charming personality.
He's far more engaging, more conversational,
yeah,
more open.
Yeah.
And it's not, I don't think it's as scripted. Maybe fake's not the right word, but as scripted as Tiger. Tiger, he'll tell you stuff that's marginally interesting, but he'll never go that extra step. He'll never say the other sentence.
Jack used to be like that, and Jack changed. Over the course of Nicklaus's career, Jack changed.
Do you think that was because of Arnie? And he sort of had to match that kind of effusive personality?
That's a very good question. I would say yes, it probably was. I don't know if he would acknowledge that, but I experienced it. You know, I got into the business in the early 70s, and Jack was still at the top of his game. And I wound up having an excellent relationship with him. And I was never a Jack guy, even though he's from the same hometown.
Yeah.
Right? I was an Arnie guy. Loved Arnie, hated Jack. But I warmed to Jack, and Jack warmed to other people.
Yeah.
Jack did not tolerate and still does not tolerate fools.
Good.
Like, if you ask him a dumb question, it'd probably be the last question he'll take from you. And he was never shy about saying that was that's a stupid question. Move on.
I don't have a problem with that from any athlete.
No. But if Jack got a sense that you knew something about the game and took him in a place that he thought was interesting, he'd give you all the time in the world. He had no, I mean, I interviewed him one-on-one at the Old Course at St. Andrews. Now, I did a bunch of interviews with him here, like one-on-one personal. We did some telephone stuff for the show, but I went over to the opening of the Old Course Hotel and interviewed Jack there. And it was easily an hour and 20 minutes. It was supposed to be like 20 minutes.
Yeah, in and out, yeah.
And we just kept going.
I think all the greats in all the sports, if you can engage them at a level that challenges them or makes them think of answers that are not rote. They're not like, oh, what'd you hit into four? Oh, 6 iron, 4 feet, made a birdie, yada, yada, yada. Okay, if you engage them at some level beyond that, the greats in the sports will engage you too. I really, really believe that. But you have to do your homework, and you can't be a fraud. You have to know what you're talking about. You can't say to a guy, talk about your life.
Yeah.
Because they kill you if they have any brains. Oh, my life's great. Bye. So I think you see it. I see it in basketball. I see it in, I know it in baseball. I presume it's the same way in the hockey, that if the great players, if you can engage them in conversation at a level that challenges them, they'll talk to you forever.
You got to find the hook.
You do, yes.
You know, what is it that interests this guy at this point in his life?
Yeah, and not what today's story is, because everybody's doing today's story.
Yeah.
It's got to be something else. That'd be something, a why question, or what's in your mind when question.
You know, the two things that I went the longest with Jack in the various conversations we had, one was he bought McGregor Golf in the 70s, I guess. Like, he played for McGregor, but then the company had problems, and he bought the company. And I asked him about that, and we went forever. I mean, went down a lot. Like, what do you do with the company, and how do you change the company? And, how do you become like the other big companies? Because McGregor at one time was one of the golf companies, one of the top two or three in the world, but it had gone into decline.
They made one of
like
the first
Spalding
blades,
did.
McGregor made one of the first blade irons?
I don't remember.
Yeah, I could be wrong, but. Yeah, but that, you're right. That
and
kind
then
of
it was
thing.
Golf course architecture was the other one, which, of course, he was still fairly new at it. Now, I mean, he's done hundreds and hundreds of courses. He's probably less interested in talking about golf course architecture. But back then, this was his baby. He would much rather go out and walk around, put his hip waders on and go walk around a piece of property and figure out how to build a golf course and go play. He didn't want to play anymore. Yeah. He would much rather do that.
It'd be interesting, wouldn't it, to talk to those old-time architects that how they would do course design now, given environmental concerns, land usage, land costs. How do you? You couldn't build. I don't think in Canada you could build Glen Abbey again, like they did back in 30 years ago, however many years ago it was.
Early 70s.
Because you can't get that. You can't get that amount of land.
40.
40 years. Wow, I'm getting old.
Well, you can't get. You know, that land is out there. You can find that land. The real point of difference, I suppose, now is, like, the whole cost of building golf courses. And we went through an era where guys were spending, like, it was $15 to $20 million was the norm. I can remember when if you built a $20 million golf course, it was like, wow.
Yeah.
And then you went through this period where, and you know what costs the most in building a golf course? Moving earth.
Moving earth. And I presume going through environmental processes.
Well, there's that too, depending
which
on the land.
Yeah. If you want to do something in protected areas or swamps or streams. There's levels of people you got to deal with that you didn't have to 40 years ago.
Yeah, at one point you just said, well, do we want the stream or not? If we don't want it, we'll close it up.
Thank you.
Fill it in.
Hey, Mr. City, I'm going to shut down this stream. Don't worry about it. You guys deal with it.
Yeah.
And they would.
But you can't do that now.
No, you can't at all.
No.
And I presume that would frustrate golf courses.
Habitat for critters, too. You got to worry about the habitat for critters.
Too many critters. I'm against critters.
Yeah. Well, there are a lot of them out there, and a lot of them bite. And that's what I
they
don't.
They do.
I don't like biting critters.
They get my way and my hair. I don't like critters.
Well, I mean, one of the great stories is, now, have you had a chance to play at the new home of golf, Goodwood?
No, I have not.
Well, I've invited you, but you've
I know.
Not been available.
Plus, my game is so bad, I'd be deathly embarrassed.
Well, no, we're not worried about that. One of the things we talk about a lot there, they moved 50,000 cubic meters of earth to build that golf club.
My math sucks, but that's a lot of earth.
Really? Think of this. The first hole, you played Devil's Pulpit?
Yes.
First hole at Devil's Pulpit, 1 million cubic meters of earth.
Wow, really?
One hole. The entire, all of Goodwood, the 18 holes, 50,000.
Huh, I'm shocked by that.
It's probably the most natural golf course that we have in this country.
Didn't know that. Yeah. I've played Pulpit, so I know exactly what you're talking about.
And everybody that I've talked to, you know, that's been in course architecture and whatever, I said, well, what's the difference between a, you know, $5 million golf course and a $10 million golf course? And you think it's going to be like, well, planting trees and green and, you know, this and that, blah, blah, blah.
The prettiness.
Moving earth.
Huh.
That's the difference in cost. The less earth you move, the cheaper it is to build the golf course.
Hmm. Where are you?
Who knew that heavy yellow equipment
costs a lot of money?
Cost that much.
I should get my kid to learn how to drive one and get a job that way.
And why is heavy equipment all yellow? Do you know the answer to that?
No. It can't be so you can see it because you know it's coming anyway because it's so big.
Why are all bulldozers and those kinds of things always yellow? Do they come in other colors? Can you choose?
You could paint it once you got it, couldn't you?
They don't, though.
Cats. No, you don't.
They're always yellow.
Good question. Good point.
Are they all made by the same company? The yellow bulldozer company? Yeah, Caterpillar's a big one, right?
I think so.
See a lot. But you see other companies other than Caterpillar, and they're yellow, too. That doesn't seem proper to me.
No. So where are you in your golf course design and golf course life on the concept of 12-hole courses? The cut down on playing time and land and cost.
See, I'm more in tune now with join a golf club that has no members because then you play fast.
Right.
Then you play 18 holes in the same time it takes 12.
Right.
See, the first thing I want to know is, are you sold out? How many members you got? How often do they play?
Yeah, because I'm not coming if it's busy and you got too many. I don't want to go for the social stuff. I don't play golf.
Not interested in the social stuff, and I'm not interested in six-hour rounds. I'm not interested in five-hour rounds. I'm really not that interested in four-hour rounds. I want to play in 2:45, you know, two guys, 2:45, four guys, 3 hours, go home.
Done.
Done. See, I can do that at my joint.
That's pretty good.
That's pretty good.
I was in Scotland years and years ago with my dad. I played at Carnoustie and Old Course and one up north at Rude Loves. Can't name it. The end of it. Right on the water. Anyway, I'm playing somewhere
in Scotland.
Yeah, with
Muirfield.
Muirfield. Not Muirfield. I'm not sure. I can't remember what it was now.
Okay,
it'll come to me. But I'm playing with an older. No. Anyway, I'll Google it later. But I play with this woman who's probably 25 years older than me at the time, and we're playing. And we're walking. It was a twosome. We're two balls, and we're playing. We're playing like 3 hours and 35 minutes. And I'm thinking, oh, I'm tired. We get done. I said, so how do we do for time? She goes, well, I'm about 40 minutes slow, but you're new. I go, I was like racing around. We even 40 minutes slow. You got to play 225?
Yeah.
It was crazy.
Yeah.
Crazy. But that's the way you play.
Yeah, and we take, you know, I think part of it's TV. Like, I hate playing with people. Especially, like, you know, I understand if you can't hit the ball and you're looking through the rough all the time, I mean, that's time consuming.
Right.
That doesn't bother me. That happens. You'd rather it didn't, but.
Royal Dornoch. That's the place.
Here's what bothers me. You know, guy's going to shoot 100 plus. Gets on the green.
He's plumb bobbing 45
footers. He's plumb bobbing and eyeballing and giving it the walk around from all sides. You know,
you got no chance to make that a million years. Hit the ball up there close, try to make the next one.
Bite me. Stand over it and hit it. You take one quick look. Well, it breaks a little left or right. Hit it left or right.
Exactly. Get it up there somewhere close.
Do you think by sitting there, some guy who can't break 100 could stand there till the cows come home and look at it from every different angle and it wouldn't make any difference?
Be totally blind luck anyway. Yes, that you're right. That's the infuriating. Those infuriating people to be behind when you're in a fairway 160 and you're watching these people do this, and they're like, You're like, come on.
Well, I haven't experienced that in a long time.
You want to hit the ball into them. Yeah. Oops, sorry.
See, we don't play behind anybody.
Well, I don't have the luxury of your life.
If there's somebody else on the front nine, we're playing the back. They're on good. Six. I don't care. I might catch them. I'm not taking that chance. Anybody on the back? Nope. Way we go.
Let's get started.
Our legal beagle, Rob Becker, joins us. You got your headset on there. Hello, Becker. How you doing?
Hi.
Oh, are you on? Wait a sec. Oh, there you are. You're on Skype, too.
Well, yes, I am.
We can hear you and see you at the same time.
Wow, this is like the modern technology. I don't like to see myself,
so.
No, well, I can understand that. You don't have a mirror sitting there?
No, but I had it. They had the Skype video was on my computer, but I minimized it so I don't have to look at myself.
Attaboy. Well, it won't distract you then.
Exactly.
Where do you want to go? You want to go baseball or football first?
I guess football. I assume you want to talk about this objection to the settlement of the concussion suit that was filed by 7 football players. And I think it makes a lot of sense, and it's hardly that surprising. I mean, we should probably quickly review that. I think, as most people know, a settlement was negotiated by the council for the class of players with the NFL. And they thought everything was hunky-dory. They would certain amounts of money would go to certain people with certain conditions. And then lo and behold, Judge Brody in Philadelphia rejected it and said that this is not okay. It does not appear that there's enough money in the fund to take care of all the claims. And that was how things were, and they were going to try and put it back together. And so the recent development is that 7 players who hired their own separate lawyer and objected to the settlement. They filed a formal objection, and basically what they're saying is it's really a criticism of the class lawyers who had represented the class of football players, saying that the class lawyers made sure to take care of themselves in terms of attorney's fees, but they didn't get enough money for their clients, the players, and therefore this is a bad deal. And they point to several things to back that up. I mean, and I think one thing, Bob, to keep in mind is that the judge, quite rightly, when she had a ruling rejecting the settlement, she realizes that whenever you've got a class action and you've got class lawyers who are representing a class and who are looking for their own fee, that the judge must be vigilant to make sure that the lawyers aren't doing the very thing they're accused of here. That is making sure they get paid a lot and their clients don't. And you could tell that she was already had serious worries on that very score. And now these guys are coming in and basically confirming all her worries and saying that that's what the lawyers have done. And they point to the thing that really caught my eye, Bob, and I have never heard of this. And I think this is a very good example of why you should be suspicious of these attorneys. They negotiated a clause in the agreement under which the NFL's lawyers promised that they would not object to the fees that the council would be getting. And the players say, look, if you negotiated for that, in other words, if you gave up something in exchange for receiving that, that means you gave up something
that was ours.
Right. Exactly. You gave us something that belonged to the clients, the players, in exchange for making sure that your fee would be approved. And instead of that, you should have been negotiating for something for the players. And I think that's a very powerful argument. And in fact, what they say is the very existence of that clause itself shows that what the council did was wrong. And I agree. I think that makes sense. The other thing that they said, which I found kind of shocking, you know, I think most people have even if you're not in legal circles, you have a general idea that in most litigation, there's this thing called discovery where, you know, you get documents for the other side. You take depositions from the other side in order to get evidence. That's an everyday thing. Well, it turns out, as these players point out, the lawyers for the players took no depositions and got no documents. So they're saying, look, these guys didn't even try hard. They didn't work hard, but they made sure they got a really good fee agreement. So and this also shows that they obviously didn't pressure the league because they didn't get the evidence that they needed to pressure the league. So for all those reasons, you know, I think this is a very powerful objection, and it's going to make it even harder now for the plaintiff's lawyers, the general lawyers and the NFL's lawyers, to save this settlement unless they do very major surgery.
So why is it only 7 who have objected? It sounds like what you laid out, that it's been a folly since the beginning. Like, why are there just 7 who are going to that level now?
Well, this doesn't quite explain why it's only 7, but I'll tell you a fact about these 7 that makes them different from many of the other plaintiffs, is that because of their type of illnesses, they would get nothing. These are guys who don't quite have the kind of chronic traumatic encephalopathy, you know, that some other people get. And the agreement specifies certain, if you have certain problems, you get certain money. And these guys don't have that, but they say, we do have concussions and we do have problems, you know, with our memory, et cetera, but we're going to get nothing. So that explains why they objected. But I think there should be more, and I think there may be more who will join in with them.
Do you think there aren't more because the guys who got money just want to get money and make this go away?
Well, some do. I mean, that's the tension that's been in this class from day one. If you're, let's say you're an older plaintiff, and you know that you want to see money before you die, and if you fight this thing, it could go on for many years and you won't see any money. So if you're older, you're more likely to want to settle and get something now. But if you're younger and you have time to fight, and plus if you're younger, you won't have the same
We get time to get sicker
symptoms.
If you're younger.
Yeah, you won't have more time and you won't have the symptoms that the older guys have. So you are more likely to object. And that's the tension from the beginning. So what you have got is seven relatively recent retirees who are objecting.
With our legal counsel, Rob Becker. So refresh my memory. I'm trying to remember what the number was on the original settlement. 750?
You know what? I've forgotten that number myself. But what I do recall, Bob, is I sat down and I calculated what the likely amount would be that you could expect these players to come up with. And to me, it was obvious that the number wasn't close. In fact, I think when I did the calculations, I thought it was reasonable that the real amount of money that would be needed by the players, even under the agreement as it was constructed, was twice the amount in the fund. And that was the general point that this judge made, that there's just not enough money. Even if you keep the rules as is in the agreement, there won't be enough money.
Right. So, Ryan, do you know what the original
I think it was $700 million. If I remember, $700 is the one.
$765 is the number. So I was pretty close.
Okay.
So $765, the legal fees awarded to the class counsel allegedly was $122.5 million.
Yeah,
that's about 15%, 14-15%.
For guys who took no depositions and did no document review.
Well, essentially, they did next to nothing together.
I mean, they did. I'll tell you what they did. They filed a complaint and they negotiated a settlement agreement. But it doesn't sound like there was all that much in between those two things.
No, I get that. What I'm trying to get at is, in many cases in this country, and I assume in the United States.
Sure.
Attorneys will work on a percentage of what they are able to get for their client. Accident claims, insurance claims, those kinds of things. There may be others. You'd be familiar probably a lot more than I would with that.
A contingency.
Thank you very much. I was led to believe that the common rate for a contingency claim for a lawyer is around 30%. Is that
right? But that's not necessarily – that's roughly accurate, but that's not necessarily what you get in a class action. And the thing is also, in a class action, you can't bill your clients like that. You can't really – it's impossible to have a contingency because you have nobody to really negotiate. You don't have clients to negotiate with. So what you have to do is hope for the best and that hope that at the end, the amount that you ask for, you show that is a reasonable percentage, and you hope that the judge will bless it as being a reasonable percentage. And that doesn't always happen.
So what would you say would be reasonable here? A quarter this amount? A tenth?
See, I wouldn't look at it. See, to me, that's not even the right question, Bob. To me, before you address something like that about how much the lawyers got, you got to make sure that the terms under which the players are going to get paid, including players like these seven, are reasonable terms.
Enough. I get that. I acknowledge that. I'm just trying to focus in on this one particular thing.
No, if it's 15%, you know, if it was really a good deal, maybe that would be enough. Okay. Maybe that would be okay right there, but not with a deal like this that doesn't get enough money for the players and which doesn't involve any real work by the lawyers.
So am I reading into this correctly that in your opinion, and perhaps in the judge's opinion, the counsel for the plaintiffs here may have been responsible for an award that's substantially less than
Absolutely.
What it should have been?
Absolutely. That's really the point, is that they did not fight hard enough to get enough money to pay these players, but they did make sure they'd be paid. And that's part of the point both of the judge back a few months ago and these players now with this objection is, lawyers, you got too little money. And that's kind of a big deal.
So if the judge upholds this objection, does it open the whole case again from the start? Or can a new judge say, we got to get to this number to satisfy these claimants?
I mean, it's conceivable that a judge would say that. I think it's unlikely the judge herself or himself would say what the number should be.
Right.
But they will more likely to just look at the number and say if they think it's too high or too low. I mean, remember that right now they're in a sense they do have to go to the they already had to go back to the drawing board. But this filing just means that when you go back to the drawing board, you got a lot of work to do because it's just totally confirms the judge's worst fears.
Well, that's an ongoing story, and who knows how long it will be ongoing. We've been talking about it for quite a while, and just when you think it's come to an end, it's it's a dead stop actually right now.
Right.
It's start over time.
Right.
Major League Baseball has rule or baseball the game of baseball has rules and regulations with regard to drug use, including marijuana, which is going to be more and more interesting as time passes, as we all know, yeah. as more and more states in the United States legalize the use of marijuana, not just for medical reasons, but for in a social environment. But as it stands right now, you smoke marijuana, you do a take a drug test, you get caught, you're a minor league baseball player, you're going to get suspended. But there are players out there, at least one in particular, who is unconcerned about this. Can you sort of explain why?
Right, because the minor league players are not represented by the union. So the rules of on suspensions for smoking marijuana for minor leaguers, they quickly go up to 50 games and beyond. They're very draconian. Meanwhile, in the major leagues, since they're represented by a union and people realize marijuana isn't that bad and certainly isn't something that helps you play baseball better, the penalties are very minor. It takes a while before you get any games, and it really isn't much. And in fact, the highest fine is $35,000. So the penalties in the majors are very small. So what happens is if you're a minor league player who's very good, you're not on the 40-man roster, but you're very good, and you know that your organization really values you and wants you to eventually
right.
make it to the majors, you know that if you're – it may even be in your interest to smoke some marijuana, because if you do and you're about to get one of these draconian suspensions that's going to put you out of action, it becomes in the major league's interest, the organization's interest, to put you on the 40-man roster, thereby preventing you from being suspended for a major amount of time so that you can still play and develop. And so apparently some of these guys are gaming the system. They figured that out, and they're actually – you could say they're intentionally smoking marijuana. It almost seems as if they would like to get caught for this very reason, to be put on the 40-man roster, which not only does it mean that they don't have a penalty, they don't have nearly as big a penalty, it also means they get more money because they're on the 40-man roster. So it's sort of a win-win. If you're a very good minor leaguer who likes to smoke marijuana, the best thing to do is probably to smoke marijuana.
Get caught and then force the major league team to move to the 40-man roster where it doesn't matter.
What?
Right.
I think we're going to see, and I presume this will eventually happen in minor league baseball, is that all major professional sports are lessening all penalties for marijuana. Like Rob, like you said, it's not a performance enhancer. It's a social drug. It's legal in some states to go and buy it. And I just wonder,
including major league cities.
Yes.
It's already legal in Denver.
Yes. And Seattle.
And Seattle. So, yep. I mean, how long can they keep, in a sense, baseball has to catch up with the times.
Yeah.
And, society is changing in various ways, and this is one of them. Marijuana is not considered such a horrible thing anymore.
And there have to be minor league baseball teams in Colorado and Washington State.
Oh, yeah.
So
right.
the people can do legally in their state what their association will suspend them for 50 or 100 games. Makes no sense to me.
Well, and when the laws changed, when after the referendum in those states, I said immediately, watch out for free agents going there in droves. I mean, it's a selling point that no other organizations have. You've got two major league organizations that have that selling point, and that's I'm being facetious, but I mean Robinson Cano going to Seattle, really? I mean, maybe there's another idea.
I hope that's not the reason the Yankees.
Well, I don't know that for a fact. I'm not suggesting that even for a second.
Okay.
But, and a guy who got caught in that a few years ago, Jeremy Jeffress was a pitcher for the Toronto Blue Jays, a relief pitcher for the Blue Jays. big, hard thrower, 100 miles an hour, didn't know where it was going half the time. But he got nailed as a minor leaguer for using marijuana. And in 2010, I believe it was the Milwaukee Brewers moved him up to their major league roster specifically for that reason, right, to avoid, so he would avoid getting another whack.
Because the major leagues are more enlightened than the minor leagues, and they understand what marijuana is in today's society and what it is to athletes in today's society.
But they've also forcibly been enlightened by the union.
Yes.
I mean, it's, you know, I mean, the minor leaguers don't have a union.
Well, they're going to have to go someplace with this, you know, as marijuana use becomes decriminalized in more and more states. And I think that's an inevitability. I don't know what the time frame is going to be.
Right.
But, you know, there'll be some Bubba and Skeeter states that'll fight this thing, you know, to the end. But, you know, the Bible Belt ain't going to go marijuana positive tomorrow, probably. But nonetheless, there's going to be a bunch of places that will. And all of a sudden, you're going to have this, you know, this draconian kind of law.
I think we all realize that even in states and provinces and countries that isn't, it hasn't decriminalized it, people turn a blind eye. This is not an issue in society anywhere anymore.
No, but it is an issue in sports where they have drug testing, and if you come back positive for marijuana, there are rules, and maybe the intent was never to punish you for marijuana use, but it's still there. They either got to change these rules or...
In the NBA that I've covered, they've relaxed the rules extraordinarily. Like it's like a third offense to get a 5-game. It's like there's nothing there. It's like Major League Baseball.
Marijuana use was the drug of choice. It was the drug of choice in the NBA.
Cocaine
for a long
time. Back in the day. Marijuana. It's like, well, you have 400 kids under the age of 30. Have you put 400 kids from Toronto under the age of 30 on the street? 250 of them would smoke pot. This is not unusual.
With a lot of spare time too, right?
And a lot of wealth.
And a lot of money.
Not unusual.
Yeah. Becker, you look beautiful. Thank you very much for joining us today, and we'll talk to you soon. There's our legal analyst, Rob Becker, in New York. I don't know whether anybody was busier than Dale Tallon over the in the few hours and during the free agent fracas. But he was predictably busy. Everybody who paid any attention knew this guy was going to be spending like there was no tomorrow, and he accomplished that objective. Dale Tallon will join us to talk about this spending spree when Primetime continues on the Sportsnet radio and television networks.
Prizes like no other, from a club like no other, the Fan Club. Log on to sportsnet590.ca.
Here's what I know. Give an NHL general manager a credit card with no limit on it, he'll exceed it. Same principle as my wife. Speaking of that, here's Dale Tallon, the general manager of the Florida Panthers. Well, you told us you were going to spend like a drunken sailor, and congratulations, you did as promised.
Yeah, I'm going to start drinking again.
That's always the right answer. Always the right answer.
Before we get to the free agent fracas stuff, take us back to the draft. Were you ever at any point close to moving that number one pick? Because you talked about the possibility.
Oh, I did. Yeah, I had two really, you know, two very good offers. I had three. Like the first offer was earlier on, right off the bat, and then I had two really good offers the day before, and they were both very tempting. When discussing with our staff and seeing what we have in place, the Barkovs and Huberdeaux and Goodbransons, that we felt that that Aaron was the right choice for us because of the character of the kid and his maturity and his size and strength. It just gave us another big piece to the puzzle, and we're not in a hurry. We're taking our time. We're doing it right. So the other two deals probably would have helped us sooner, but. It's hard to find when you talk to everyone that before the draft and after the draft and before free agency and after free agency, they're all looking for the big right-handed shot defenseman.
Yeah.
We've got a surplus of them now.
But you had indicated to me, at least, and probably to many other people, anybody who asked, that I got the sense, Dale, that your inclination was to move that pick if you got something reasonable. And it sounds like you got something reasonable here. Something happened, you know, in terms of your opinion.
No, it just wasn't enough. You know?
Oh, okay.
Just, when I just discussed, it just wasn't enough. It was close, but it just wasn't, it didn't feel right at the end. So that's all. You know, it was very tempting, but it just didn't feel right. And it felt better to go this route.
So you sign a whack of free agents.
Yes.
We understand that, you know, you had to get not only to the minimum, but I've said to people who've asked me, I said, I figure Dale's going to be somewhere in the mid-60s by the time all is said and done. Now, whether you will be or won't be.
That's where we're at right now.
Yeah, so... was there a common selling point? Now, I know it's about money. I get that. Everybody gets that. But at some point, you sit down and you have to say to the agent, to the kid, we'll pay you a whack of dough, but here's why you want to come to Florida. What followed here's why you want to come to Florida?
We have Luongo now. We have goaltender. We have new ownership. We have a new coach, Gerard Gallon, very popular guy. Everybody likes Gerard. Players talk. And then we have tremendous asset value. You know, we interviewed 12 coaches prior to the draft as well, and they all wanted to come here for the reasons that I just mentioned, especially the young depth of talent that we have throughout our organization and through center ice and in the back end. So we're becoming a place that, you know, the future is very bright. So a lot of positives, and that's what we sold, you know. And plus, it helps to have good relationships with some of the players that were available in free agency.
At any point do you sell? And by the way, the beach is right there. And there's no state tax.
Well, yeah, that's all part of the package. You know, you hope that has something to do with it. But you know what? I've offered that for a long time, and it didn't matter. It was about perception, about winning, and caring, and about making the right moves and wanting to build a team that can contend for a long time. Hey, and that's what it boils down to.
Hey, Dale, it's Doug Smith. When you get to the free agent day and you do the first signing, how much does that impact the next thing you do? Like you say, okay, I got this guy, I should go get that guy, and then I should go get this guy because he works well with these two guys. How much does it become like a momentum thing that day?
It did, because I'll tell you, the first half hour at 12:30, I figured, why all that nonsense and all that talking from the 25th of June, it was for naught. And I'm going, what's going on here? And then it started with Jokinen, and that was the piece we wanted to play with Barkov, you know, because of his history and they, you know, they got to know each other through the Olympics, and Barkov, you know, would have an advisor, a mentor, and a guy that could put the puck in the net for him. And then it just kept going, you know. Like that seemed to open the floodgates for us, because then we got everybody that we wanted, and it was turned out to be exactly the way we had planned it. And that doesn't happen very often.
Was there one guy you got that you were surprised you got?
Well, I think that we were surprised that we got Jokinen right away. You know,
yeah.
I mean that happened quickly. And it wasn't a lot of negotiating. It was, what's the number? Are you willing to do this? And then we said, yes, let's do it. And then we got a call back and got a new Panther. And so that made us feel good. And then it just, you know, we were hoping to get three guys and we ended up getting six. So that's, you know, just, I've been to the other end where nobody's come.
Well, yeah.
That's really frustrating. It's happened a few times. And then the last 2 years, we weren't able to even answer the phone because we had no budget to do it. So that's why we went a little silly this year, because I tell you, you don't want to have the same feeling we had last July 1st after we left there. Peter Mahovlich and I were going to start drinking again.
I think that's the right answer.
And that's not pretty. Because Peter and I played together in Pittsburgh, and it wasn't pretty.
hey, Dale, when you get to July 1st and this thing begins, how much of, I'm not suggesting you did this or your team did this, but how much of is it preempting other teams from doing things when you do signings? Like, I got to get this guy because I don't want him to go to there.
That never comes into it. I mean, that never comes into it. You know, you at the end of the day, you go, oh, geez, we got lucky that guy didn't go there or this guy. But no, that's not the reason for doing it. I have no idea what the other teams are trying to do. And, you know, it's a bonus if it happens, but that's not the goal at all. There's no discussion whatsoever about that.
How hard-nosed are you on term, length of contract specifically? Is that
we're trying to cut that down. I mean, I don't like to go past five.
No, I know.
Four was ideal, but five was, you know, with David, you know, they're looking for seven and six, and we were prepared to pay a little bit more money for less term. You know, I think five is the maximum.
So Bolin got five and Jokinen got four, is that right?
Yes.
If I remember correctly?
Yes.
Yeah. Now what? What do you got? What do you think you have to do between now and 1st of September?
Well, I'm going to wait and see how these kids play this week in prospects camp and rookie camp. I'm going to sit tight now for a while and see, and then maybe tweak, go sideways in a couple of things, you know. But you know, it's always you know, like another speedy, mobile type defenseman, but. We're good right now. We're going to sit tight and see how these kids come through the summer.
Do you think you're a playoff team right now?
I think we're a team that's going to compete hard for a playoff. We'll be in it all the way through. That's, you know, it's not imperative, but we will be competitive. And it's hard to say. You just never know until it all comes together. You know, a lot of pieces that are new to the whole
thing.
Well,
sure.
And we're still young, but. If Barkov and Bjugstad stay healthy and have good years and Huberto bounces back and these other guys play like we think they can, we got two good goalies, you know, we got three goalies actually, you know, so we're good there, and we're better all around, especially with character and grit and leadership.
Has that enthusiasm caught on with the fans, it being what time of year it is, mm-hmm. and this week has been very hectic and exciting? Are you getting the sense that the casual sports fan there is okay, well, there's something going on here that we need to pay attention to?
I it's hard to get a feel. I've been so busy, you know, just starting to come up for air. And, you know, I would think so based on what we've had in the last couple of days with marketing and sales, and also with some media coverage that's real positive, and, you know, the tweets, et cetera. So there's a little bit more activity, but it's hard to really judge, you know, this time of the year.
Well, you've demonstrated a tremendous skill set at spending other people's money, and we congratulate you for that. And as I said at the top of the show, you're exactly like my wife. I know she has the exact same skill set that you have.
Yeah, someone stole my wife's American Express card. I haven't reported it because he's spending less than she was.
Good line. You can't finish on a better one than that. Thank you, Talon.
All right.
Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Dale
Talon, general manager of the Florida Panthers. He's one of my favorites. Never a dull moment.
That's a good guy.
You know, he does yeoman's work. He's very good at his job, and he's a fun guy. And one of the least guarded general managers talk to.
Very open, talking about what he got and why he did it and needed to get these guys in a hurry. And just,
yeah, I wonder sometimes, like after the fact, I understand before the fact, but after the fact, why these guys are so tight with information. Like it's a national guarded secret. Talon has never deals with it that way. Well, here's what happened. You know, and it's all very casual. You got to love him. Matt Devlin, one of your pals, will join us on the program, voice of the Toronto Raptors. We'll talk a little bit about the Lowry signing and what it means and the domino effect, and now the big wait to see what the big four are going to do and how long will that take. And then the Ottawa Red Blacks are set to take the field. Stupidly, they open in Winnipeg. Huh? Back in a bit on Primetime.